It's Friday, May 29, 2020, just after market close here in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington here in New York, joined shortly by Ed Harrison in Washington, D.C. But first, Peter Cooper with the latest market news.
Thanks, Ash. I'm going to talk about Canada. Statistics Canada released a new report today concerning some of the country's most recent economic data and how they have fared in light of the coronavirus pandemic. In the first quarter of 2020, Canada's annualized GDP contracted 8.2%. This number is slightly better than what was expected. Economists were predicting a 10% decline, but an 8.2% contraction in Canada's GDP on an annualized basis during the first quarter is steeper than the US, whose output contracted 5%. Statistics Canada also released a preliminary estimate for April output, which showed a drop of 11% following a 7.2% contraction in March. This is the most severe contraction in Canada since the 2008 financial crisis, and it's expected to be the deepest contraction of the Canadian economy since World War II. About 3 million Canadians lost their jobs in March and April, and over a third of the labor force is now unemployed or experiencing displacement, such as reduced work hours, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. As a result, Canadian household spending fell 2.3% in the first quarter, which is the largest quarterly decline recorded. During the same period, the household savings rate went up to 6.1% in the first quarter, as opposed to 3.6% in the previous quarter. Statistics Canada also reported that Canada's consumer price index for April fell by 0.2% on a one-year basis, which makes Canada one of the first major economies to be under deflationary pressure for consumer prices. The Bank of Canada expects the GDP level to be 15 to 30% lower in the second quarter from the end of 2019. The central bank had acted early in March when they cut interest rates from 1.75% to 0.25% and participated in quantitative easing for the first time. And the Canadian government also responded with a fiscal stimulus package worth about 240 billion Canadian dollars. And with that, I'll hand it over to Ash.
Welcome, Ed. We've made it through another week.
Yes, I'm happy for the weekend, I got to tell you.
I feel like we've been on camera twice today. Is that right?
I think that is the case. And you've been the host both times.
Yes. Yes, I have. You know, this is it's been another week in markets. Let's just take a look here at what's happened. So, you know, S&P is up about half a percentage point to the 3044 level. Dow basically flat, up 0.1%. NASDAQ, a little momentum, up 120 points, plus 1.3%.
Yes. And, you know, I think that the news from President Trump earlier today, the markets actually reacted relatively positively to the news, which included stripping Hong Kong of some of its special status and also pulling out of the WHO, both moves which were basically against China from the United States perspective.
Yeah, not a slow news day by any means. What were your thoughts about those two key stories?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I was looking at it is as confirmation of this thesis that the what was a trade war before the coronavirus hit has become a cold war of sorts now, that we're seeing an escalation. And so the first thing that I thought to myself was, what's the likely salvo from the Chinese on the other side? And I think that the likely salvo is a further escalation of sorts, some sort of tit for tat. I don't think it's going to be a de-escalation in terms of, okay, now we're going to buy more of your stuff to fulfill our agreement on the trade front. It's rather going to be acrimony of some sort. And so a furthering of this Cold War mentality that we're seeing.
Yeah, unfortunately, that seems as though it may be the case. You know, it's been a pretty big news day when the president signing an executive order potentially limiting some of the protections that social media companies have. You know, when that doesn't even make the top two stories, it's been a big news day.
Yeah, and unfortunately, a lot of it is geopolitical, you know, which is outside of our wheelhouse. Certainly, you know, I don't know how to react about the riots that are going on and what that means from a market perspective.
Yeah.
I think that it's a net negative for the likes of Google and Amazon and all of the tech companies, what happened in terms of the social media thing. But let's just see how that plays out. I have more of a view on China, just because when you look back at the last global recession that we had, the Chinese were very instrumental in terms of the amount of stimulus that they added, in terms of the boost that we got to the economy. And right. So to the degree that we're now in this Cold War type situation, that's going to be negative for growth. And I think that it's going to put a headwind on risk assets. And it definitely does have a market impact, whereas the other two, I think, are less, it's less sure what the market impact is going to be.
Yeah, you know, very good points. I think the short back of the envelope answer is probably additional risk coming on to the table in the form of, you know, potential political and social instability, and obviously a potential headwind for FANG stocks and certainly for Twitter. But, you know, before we go too far down that rabbit hole, I just wanted to say I especially enjoyed your interview with Double On Capital's Bill Campbell this week. I thought it was just really interesting to hear him really unpack some of the mechanics of what's happening in Europe and also in China. It's just incredibly tied to a factual analysis of the mechanics of how public policy, monetary policy, fiscal policy, trade policy get implemented in those regions. What were your takeaways from that interview?
You know, what I thought was that it's amazing how Double Line, how broad their focus is. And just so you know, I mean, you know this already, that Double Line is run by Jeff Gundlach, and he's the CIO of the company. Bill, he works hand in glove with Jeff in terms of making decisions. So, you know, this is Bill representing Double Line in terms of what their asset allocation is. So normally we think of Double Line in terms of, you know, what they're doing in the United States. But what Bill was showing us is basically that they have a much broader scope in terms of what they're thinking about, both in terms of rate policy and in terms of bonds. And that's a very sophisticated outfit in terms of their holistic view of where you can invest, where there's relative value to be made. I think that it was a great understanding both of what the market risks are, but also what's driving those risks from a political economy and an economic perspective. And you have to know that if you're dealing with global markets, bonds and FX. And so that was my takeaway.
Yeah, very well said, Ed. And let me just ask you, there were two points that stood out to me, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on them. The first was that he had a very nuanced way of thinking about the EU aid package, the potential for debt mutualization, or potentially the possibility that may not occur. And he said, he basically said that that the new 500 billion euro package that they're putting into place is not a permanent fixture of the EU budget. And he called it a, quote, clever way to skirt the issue, meaning of not creating a true fiscal transfer. And he said, this is not a Hamiltonian moment. I'm curious what your thoughts were about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm known to be somewhat skeptical of the ability of Europe to get it in line over the short term, though I think that over the long term, they do get it in line. You know, when push comes to shove, they understand what's on the table. Merkel shows that, but they're not willing to make the next move until it's existential. So I largely agree with what he was saying. What I would say is that in subsequent days since we did that interview, it's clear to me that, yes, he's correct, that this isn't a Hamiltonian moment, that, in fact, this is something that is a special program. It has a sell-by date, and when it goes away, it'll go away. It's almost like the border controls within Europe. That is that during this coronavirus period, they set up border controls. There's no way, no how, that we should be thinking that that's going to be a permanent fixture of how the market works. It's just for this particular time that the Schengen agreement market is closed down in that way. And I think that you could say the same thing about this. This isn't a, you know, Pandora's box that's being opened. And so eventually the Frugal Four will fall into line. They'll have some sort of fudge, and then we'll just move on from there.
Yeah, you know, that's such an interesting metaphor. The Schengen area is not going away, and permanent mutualization of fiscal policy is not here to stay. I was thinking when I was listening to it, this is really just such the perfect interview for Ed Harrison to be doing, because these were so in your wheelhouse. And the second thing that he said that I'm curious to hear your view on, because it's also so in your wheelhouse, was he was talking about what it would take for China to develop a reserve currency with the UN. And he talked about effectively, I think what he called them were institutional requirements. And he said, look, you know, the US has deep, liquid, open capital markets with decades, even centuries of history. The US has robust reporting standards, disclosure requirements for corporations, and perhaps most important of all, we have an open capital account. These are all challenges that, or just, you know, a sort of placement along the development continuum where China has not yet gotten. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that when you look back on it and reflect.
No, I agree with him. And I think it's a view that other people have made. That is that, you know, the dollar is the best currency of fiat currencies that are out there, bar none. There's no imminent threat from any other currencies. And if you think about other standards that we've had where there were other reserve currencies, let's not talk about gold per se, but, you know, when the British pound was preeminent, a lot of that had to do with their flow. That is the flows came through the UK, through the British Empire, and that facilitated, that greased the engines of trade. And that's the position that they held. The Chinese, they're a closed economy, relatively speaking. And as a result of that, it makes it very difficult for them to serve that liquidity function. When we're always talking constantly about the Fed this, the Fed that, is there any way, shape, or form that you can think of where the PBOC would be performing the role that the Fed is performing now in the next 5 years, the next 10 years? I mean, I don't see it in any way, shape, or form. And so therefore, I don't understand where the bid would come for using yuan in any sense, because the dollar is facilitating that role. You could call it my liberalism bias. That is that, you know, free markets, open economy, those kinds of things are the sort of thing that are facilitating the dollar in that role. And if your economy is not as open, then you aren't going to be able to play the liquidity role that the U.S. dollar is playing.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it also sets up the nice flavor for what happens over the course of that interview. If you haven't already seen it, do check it out, because it's a really strong piece.
And let me make an analogy, I think, that goes back to something that Roger was saying about, you know, let's call it the Frankfurt versus London paradigm. So what happens when the EU and the UK are separated on a permanent basis? Because, you know, the Frankfurt's not a replacement for London in terms of what I would call flows, that London has developed a place in the world that allows it to have flows run through it. It's the perfect infrastructure. So, you know, when everything is done with the EU and with the UK with regard to Brexit, London will still play a very important role just because of the infrastructure it's set up. And I would make that analogy with regard to the U.S. dollar and the role that the U.S. dollar plays in the reserve currency status. Similarly, you could also look at, going back to China, Hong Kong versus Singapore. I think that what Trump did today, you know, is the first nail or the last nail, whichever, in the coffin for Hong Kong as a center in Asia that's similar to the center that London is for Europe. I think that you're going to see an increasing number of flows go to other markets and away from Hong Kong, because it's not a place where you can expect the rule of law to prevail.
Yeah. Important points about Hong Kong, and we can pick up on those again in a moment. But I'm curious to hear you sort of unpack for people who don't follow international capital flows as closely as you do. What are some of the characteristics or parameters that make London such an ideal location currently for international capital flows?
I think it's intellectual capital. banking infrastructure, historical, what I would call the establishment of protocols. You know, when you think about British law, as an example, as being the law where a lot of debentures are based on, that's because of a history of dealing with these kinds of things. So all of these things have built up. Actually, before the United States was the world's reserve currency, the UK, you know, has actually afforded itself this role because of its role in the past, because of flows that came through and the built-up history that it has. Whereas Frankfurt, as an example, is a city of, you know, 500,000 or 600,000. It's not even one of the top five cities in Germany in terms of size. And so in many ways, it's not really a place that you could say rivals London in terms of its infrastructure, its architecture, and its preparedness for being able to take over the role that London plays today.
Right. You know, it sounds like the simple answer to that is that it's basically human capital, the human capital stock, to use a phrase that Kevin Hassett recently got in trouble for saying in a slightly different context.
Right. And you know, so when people talk about the UK leaving the EU permanently, whether it be a clean Brexit or a negotiated agreement, is it going to be Paris instead of Frankfurt? There are a lot of, is it going to be, Switzerland? I think that Roger, he made a good case for it not being in Zurich. It's being continuing to have a lot of flows go through London.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that I'm certain of is that all of those great European capitals are going to be competing aggressively to be the next center for capital flows, because it's going to mean tens or hundreds of billions of dollars in the years and decades to come for the country that's able to supplement, even if it's only a portion of the capital flows that get transferred on a net basis out of London after Brexit.
Yeah. And, you know, let's think about that in the context that I mentioned before: Hong Kong, Singapore, and to a degree, Shanghai, other places. I think that the Chinese want, they're fine with sacrificing Hong Kong and moving the center onto the shores of China in some capacity, having the flows go through a Chinese city on mainland China. But then you have Singapore as a potential rival there. And so the sense that I'm getting is that, for good or for bad, is that, you know, we're in a world now where the Chinese have decided that it's clear that they have their sphere of influence, and the United States has theirs, and there's no more Chimerica. We're not joined at the hip anymore. There's a rivalry that's there, and it won't go away, and it's only going to escalate. And they're prepared to do whatever is necessary in order to continue their growth, continue their employment in that new world. I said on the AMA that we did today that I thought Russell Clark, he made a good case for the Chinese being prepared for that eventuality, having the export channels in order to be able to master this transition well. You know, you have two different views. You have a view that says that the Chinese, they have too much debt, they're too externally dependent, and therefore this is going to be a hard transition for them, and therefore they have no good alternative to a negotiated agreement with the Americans. And then you have the view that I think Russell Clark, in the interview that he did with Rao that came out today, says very well, that actually, no, the Chinese, not only do they have raw materials at their access in Africa and in Latin America, but they also have export within Asia. In fact, because they are Asian, potentially they could create a sphere of influence in the exact same way that the United States has done in the Americas. So that is a potential outcome from this new Cold War that's happening.
You know, one of the things that you said that was rather interesting to me, at least, was the idea of potentially moving the banking center to mainland China. And the question that I had is, you know, might a cynic say that in 5 years, Hong Kong will be mainland China. There will be a distinction without a difference. The Shenzhen River that separates the two will be no more material a barrier than the Hudson River is for those of us here in New York, cut off from mainland America.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I would think that that is a move that would be fraught with peril. You know, people talk about the same sorts of things. There was a Chinese general who was talking about Taiwan in the same fashion. But clearly, you know, when there's turbulence globally, pandemic, economic turbulence, then all sorts of opportunities open up that countries want to take advantage of, and nothing's off the table over the medium term, over the next 2 to 5 years. And I think that's what you were talking about, 5 years,
yeah,
10 years. We just have no way of knowing what's going to happen. And so there's a lot of volatility in terms of the geopolitical situation facing us going forward.
Yeah, you know, and that volatility is driven in large measure just by the complexity of the issues that are involved here. And I think that your points cued that up rather nicely. It gives you a sense of the, you know, complexity, indeterminacy, and interdependence of all of these regions, and just how complicated it is to attempt to, you know, project forward over a period like 5 years and have a reasonable simulacrum of what you think is going to happen. It's just very challenging.
So, I mean, yeah, let's think about it and break it up into four buckets. We'll call it emerging markets, China, Europe, and we'll call it North America, forgetting about Japan for a second. And in terms of where the excess growth is going to come going forward as compared to, say, 2008 or 2000. Now, in the early 2000s and periods past, all of the incremental growth coming out of a global recession came from the United States. The first time that we saw that that was not the case was in the 2007 to 2009 recession and then the recovery, where it was really, you know, a supercharged, infrastructure-charged Chinese stimulus-led recovery that brought us out of that. So in the absence of this, let's say, where the world is not benefiting from that as one potential outcome as a result of the Cold War, then we're therefore looking to emerging markets or to Europe or to the United States again. And with the debt levels that we're seeing in the developed world, that includes the EU and the US, it's very unlikely, in my view, that we will not see significant deleveraging, meaning that we're going to see slow growth over the longer term. So that leaves you only with emerging markets for any sort of growth. And then you have to make a bet about specific countries and their ability to have wherewithal in this particular environment. So those are the kinds of things that I think when you talk about the indeterminacies that you have to think about that are going to affect, trade flows. They're going to affect markets, both equity and debt, as well as currency markets.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. You suggest that there's if growth is going to be driven by emerging markets, and emerging markets are not a monolithic block. There's going to be some heterogeneity there in terms of those individual stories. What are the particular emerging markets that you're looking at, and why?
Well, one that I'm looking at that I think is not going to necessarily be a leader is South Africa, as an example, because they're now just getting hit by the pandemic in a very hard way. There's increased economic insecurity and what I would say income inequality in the country as a result of the policies over the past number of years. But in addition to that, you have to think that they have huge debts that they have to pay going forward, and they're one of the fragile countries in the emerging markets. Obviously, the same thing is true for Turkey. Same thing is true for Argentina. So I would say that it's difficult, unless you're an emerging market specialist, to really, you know, go into specific countries that you think will come out better on the other side. And I'm not an emerging market specialist, so I couldn't say, you know, who are the shining stars. I can definitely tell you who are the countries that I would avoid, and those are three or four right there.
Yeah. And at times, avoiding some of the worst performers is in some ways better than being, you know, believing that you can pick the winners. You know, it's really such an interesting point that you mentioned about COVID. Obviously, COVID now ravaging South America. You know, it's going to be interesting to tease out whether or not these are seasonal effects. It's obviously a terrible impact on a human level. And, you know, on the day today that President Trump has withdrawn or is moving to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization. Do you think that that is a significant and material change in terms of global health and preparedness? Or do you think this is just a political statement that doesn't have much impact?
I that's not in my wheelhouse, so I can't really.
Me either. That's why I'm asking. I just have no idea.
I think it's on its face, it's very political, but it can't possibly be positive in terms of global preparedness to the degree that the World Health Organization played any positive role in terms of global preparedness already. So withdrawing is only going to inflict pain on the World Health Organization, and Trump believes, therefore, on China, but it's not going to help global preparedness.
Yeah, that seems right to me, too. I mean, clearly, it's not going to be a help. I guess the question that I have, just because I'm just not knowledgeable about that particular sector, is how great a hindrance it's going to be. Is it something that's just a marginal impact, or is it something that's really substantial? I just don't know the answer to that question.
And you know, the reason you don't have the answer to the question, and the reason that you're asking it to begin with, is why this is such a difficult situation, especially today. Today, again, points out how much not just policy, but politics, geopolitics is driving events right now on the ground. And what I'd like to see actually at Real Vision going forward is, you know, us thinking about who are the right players to tell that story from a historical context. What is this similar to in terms of the times that we're living through, just from the upheaval? Is it, as we have postulated many times, similar to the Great Depression? Or is there a 1968 scenario where there was a lot of social upheaval, which makes some relevance? I'd love to hear a historian talk about the relevance of politics in terms of the economy. The reason I bring up 1968 as an example, everyone knows about the secular bear market that we had from 66 to 82. Actually, 68 was really the top for the economy in the United States. It rolled over. We had a recession in 1970. And from there, you know, we had that lost decade in the 1970s. So I think that there is something to be said for, the economy and large social movements having a mutual effect on one another.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that completely. And it's so interesting. Here we are, two markets guys having a conversation about markets, and we're talking about the World Health Organization. That in itself tells you how far outside the traditional parameters of markets we have gone with the events that are on the ground. But the reality is, exactly as you suggest, Ed, that if that is driving sentiment, if that is driving pricing, we're going to cover it. And it is an interesting question about how we're going to do that. And, I think the one great thing about Real Vision is that we're nimble enough to figure out ways of doing it. We can change on a dime. We can have this conversation on a Friday and then do something new on Monday. It's going to be interesting to see how we do that. And I'm actually fascinated by it because while these are obviously very difficult times, and again, generating a lot of human suffering, they are also, intellectually compelling to understand how these things function, how they interact, and how they cause the reaction function and price discovery in markets.
Yeah, and it goes back to something that during the AMA that Roger was saying about developing frameworks and tweaking those frameworks or even throwing them out or remodeling them entirely based upon understandings that you glean from other smart people who are looking at it from a different perspective. So, there are some historical perspectives you can look at, whether those be in terms of, secular and cyclical patterns, but there are also technical indicators that you can look at in historical times and put this in that measure. Roger was doing that with regard to the Fibonacci retracement up to 62, where, yep, you know, it was only the Volmageddon where we went to the 76 level. But what about the intersection of, you know, political science and the economy? Is it true that the economy leads the social interaction, or is there some sort of reflexivity there at specifically very momentous times in world history? I'm thinking in particular, as I say that, of Neil Howe as an example, in terms of his fourth turning. He's someone who I spoke to earlier this year. He has a very interesting point of view on this.
Yeah, and it's also something that, you know, is obviously it's politically sensitive, but we have a significant bellwether election coming up in November, and there's going to be an impact from that. And how we think about that and the impact it has, certainly going to have reaction function on markets.
Without a doubt, Ash, 100%.
Yeah. You know, I would only add to that, leave us your ideas in the comments. We're curious about what you're interested in hearing about, what frameworks you think apply here, and what are the questions that you have and who can answer them in terms of being able to build up a framework and a viewpoint that adds the most value to the way you think about markets.
Yeah. So, you know, Ash, just adding on to that, over the near to medium term, let's say out to 6 months, really, we're talking about the pandemic now. So I think that we're at an inflection point. We're at a pause where it's not clear, you know, how much of a second wave we're going to get, whether or not the pandemic will move from the Southern Hemisphere back to the Northern Hemisphere in the fall, and, you know, whether or not the reopening is going to adjust very well. So we're sort of at a pause where we're taking that all that information in. But at the same time, you know, the you and I were just having is about the longer term, the 2 years, 5 year time horizon, and the, sort of these secular trends that are developing that I think are going to be very important over the course of the next, you know, cycle that we're going to be living in. So there are two time frames at a minimum that, to think about, even beyond the immediate present.
Yeah, the time frame very much remains a question. One of the things that I've noticed, I have a lot of friends who have kids who are in college or going off to college, and I've been watching on Facebook the wide divergence of opinion about when schools are going to reopen. When I saw, I guess it was last week, that Cambridge University was canceling classes until summer of 2021, I thought it was a typo. But BBC is running with that story. It's out there. And it just gives you a sense of the divergence about how institutions are thinking about opening or not reopening and what timetable that's going to be on. And obviously, those different outcomes are associated with dramatically different potential economic performance if you think about them as being a proxy for the broader economy.
But, you know, here's a question. So what is the framework that you use to model that out in terms of just from a top-down perspective, how to think about dealing with that level of uncertainty? I mean, because the way that I'm looking at it is as economic friction. And that, you know, irrespective of what your baseline is for the economy, that whenever you add economic friction, then on a overall level, you're going to get lower nominal growth. And then the only question is who are the winners and who are the losers? And right now, I think the markets are generally talking about the winners and the losers with, you know, the likes of Microsoft, you know, Facebook, Apple, Google being the winners. And then, you know, the likes of the small cap 2000 being the losers.
Yeah, you know, I sort of my cynical interpretation is because that's what markets do. Markets are about picking winners and losers. And, you know, that may not be, as you suggest, in terms of framework, the best or most edifying framework to look at something like how we're going to reopen an economy. Markets are very good at picking relative winners and losers, for example, in particular sectors where you can make apples to orange comparisons. But this is something, you know, we get tired of using the word unprecedented, but there's simply no historical precedent for anything like this. And trying to figure out what the role, you know, which direction, the directionality of it. So how the economy feeds into markets and also how markets are going to, you know, be some sort of index or indicator of future economic progress. All very complicated questions. Once again, Ed, another full conversation. Thanks for joining us. Please have a good weekend, everyone.